telling her what he just had. "Look, maybe we can skip lunch today," he said. "I'll get to San Diego earlier and take care of my business, then maybe tomorrow on my way back up we get together for lunch or dinner. If I'm lucky down there and get everything done, we might be able to do breakfast tomorrow." Breakfast was her favorite meal, and the old town near the college was full of good places to get it. "I have morning classes," Maddie said, "but let's try it tomorrow for lunch or dinner." "You sure that's okay?" he asked. "Yes, sure. But what were you going to tell me?" He decided he didn't want to scare her by warning her to be extra careful, because the case he was working might overlap into her world. He'd save that for the next day and an in-person conversation. "It can wait," he said. "I'll call you in the morning to figure out what will work." They ended the conversation, and Vosh brooded on it for the next hour as he made his way down through Orange County. He hated the idea of burdening his daughter with anything from his past or his present. He didn't think it was fair. Chapter 26. Vosh was making slow but steady progress toward San Diego when he caught the call from Chief Valdez he knew would come. "You busted Deputy Chief Creighton?" It was said equally as both a question and a statement of shock. "He's not a deputy chief anymore," Vosh said. "He's not even a cop." "It doesn't matter," Valdez said. "You have any idea what this is going to do for relations between the two departments?"
"Yeah, it's going to improve them. Nobody liked the guy at LAPD. You were there. You know that."
"No, I don't. And it doesn't matter. I just kicked the guy loose."
Vosh was not surprised.
"Why?"
he asked anyway.
"Because you've got no case," Valdez said. "You had an argument. That's all Lopez heard. You say you were threatened? He can turn around and say you threatened him. It's a pissing match. You've got no corroborating witness, and no one at the DA's office will go anywhere near this."
Vosh assumed Lopez was the desk officer. It was good to know that Valdez had at least investigated the complaint Vosh had written before he released Creighton.
"When did you kick him loose?" he asked.
"He just walked out the door," Valdez said, "and he wasn't happy. Where the hell are you, and why'd you leave?"
"I'm working a case, Chief, and it doesn't involve San Fernando. I had to keep moving."
"It involves us now. Creighton says he's going to sue you and us."
It was good to hear Valdez use the name the rank and file had christened Creighton with. It told Vosh that the chief was ultimately in his corner. Vosh thought of Mitchell Marin, the mailman who was threatening a lawsuit as well.
"Yeah, well, tell him to get in line," he said. "Chief, I gotta go."
"I don't know what you are doing, but watch yourself out there," Valdez said. "Guys like Creighton, they're no good."
"I hear you," Vosh said.
The freeway opened wide when he finally crossed into San Diego County. By 2:30 he had parked underneath a section of the 5 that was elevated over Logan Barrio and was standing in Chicano Park. The internet photos didn't do the murals justice. In person the colors were vibrant and the images startling. The sheer number of them was staggering. Pillar after pillar, wall after wall of paintings greeted the eye from every angle. It took him 15 minutes of wandering through to find the mural that listed the names of the original artists. The wreath of zinnias was now hiding even more of the lower mural, and the names of the artists. Vosh squatted down and used his hands to part the flowers and read the names. While many of the murals in the park looked like they had been repainted over the years to keep the colors and messages vibrant, the names behind the flowers had faded and were almost unreadable. Vosh took out his notebook. He was thinking that he might need to write down the names he could read, and then hope those artists could be contacted and lead him to Gabriella. But then he saw the tops of letters from names that were below the soil line. He put down the notebook, reached in, and started pulling back the dirt and uprooting the zinnias. The first name he uncovered was Lucas Ortiz. He moved right and continued his trenching, his hands getting dirty with the dark, moist soil. Soon he uncovered the name Gabriella. He excitedly picked up the pace and was just clearing the dirt from the last name Lita when a booming voice struck him from behind. "Cabrón!"
Bosch startled, then turned and looked over his shoulder to see a man behind him, with his arms stretched wide in the universal stance that says, "What the fuck are you doing?" He was wearing a green work uniform. Bosch jumped up. "Hey, sorry," he said. "Lo siento." He started wiping the dirt off his hands, but both were caked with wet soil, and it wasn't going anywhere. The man in front of him was mid-50s with graying hair and a thick, wide mustache to go with a thick, wide body. An oval patch over the pocket of his shirt said Javier. He wore sunglasses, but they didn't hide his angry stare at Bosch. "I wanted to see," Bosch began. He turned and pointed down toward the bottom of the pillar. "Los nombres," he said. "Under, debajo la tierra?" "I can speak English, fool. You're fucking up my garden. What's wrong with you?" "Sorry, I was looking for a name, an artist who was one of the originals here. There was a lot of them." Javier walked past Bosch and squatted down where Bosch had been. He started using his own hands to carefully put the uprooted flowers back into place, handling each one far more gently than Bosch had. "Lucas Ortiz?" he asked. "No, the other one," Bosch said. "Gabriela Lida. Is she still around? Who wants to know?" "I'm a private invest—" "No. Who wants to know?" Bosch understood. "If you can help me, I'd like to pay for the damage I did there." "How much you pay?" It was time for Bosch to reach into his pocket for his money, but his hands were dirty. He looked around and saw a tiled fountain that was part of the centerpiece of the park. "Hold on," he said. He walked over and dipped his hands into the fountain's pool and rubbed the dirt off. He then shook them and reached into his pocket. He checked his money fold and chose 3 of the 420s he had. He went back to Javier. He hoped he wasn't about to spend 60 bucks to be told Gabriela Lida was dead and in the ground like her name on the pillar. Javier shook his head when Bosch got back to him. "Now you fucked up my fountain," he said. "The dirt gets in the filter and I gotta clean it." "I've got 60 bucks," Bosch said. "It covers everything. Where can I find Gabriela Lida?" He held the money out and Javier took it with a dirty hand. "She used to work here and was in charge of the collective," he said. "But now she's retired. Last I heard, she still lived in the Mercado." "She lives in the market?" Bosch asked. "No, cabrón. The Mercado. It's a housing complex, man, over there on Newton." "The last name is still Lida?" "That's right." That's all Bosch needed. He headed back to his car. 10 minutes later, he parked in front of the main entrance of a sprawling complex of nicely kept low-income apartments in a neo-adobe style. He checked a residence listing in the entryway, and soon afterward knocked on a freshly painted green door. Bosch was holding the cardboard folder from Flashpoint Graphics down by his side. He raised his other hand to knock again, just as the door was pulled open by a statuesque woman, who by Bosch's calculations had to be at least 70, but looked younger. She had sharply defined cheekbones and startling dark eyes set against still smooth brown skin. Her hair was long and silver. Polished turquoise hung from her ears. Bosch slowly lowered his hand. He had no doubt that this was the woman from the photo all these years later. "Yes," she said. "Are you lost?" "I don't think so," Bosch said. "Are you Gabriela Lida?" "Yes, I am." "What is it you want?" Haller had told Bosch it would be his call to make when the moment arose. That moment was now, and Bosch felt there was no need and no time to run a game with this woman. "My name's Harry Bosch," he said. "I'm an investigator down from L.A., and I'm looking for Dominic Santanello's daughter." The mention of the name seemed to sharpen her eyes. Bosch saw equal parts curiosity and concern. "My daughter doesn't live here. How do you know she is Dominic's daughter?" "Because I started with him and it brought me to you. Let me show you something." He brought up the folder, took the elastic band off it, and opened it in front of her, holding it like a music stand so she could see the photos and page through them. He heard her breath catch in her throat as she reached forward and lifted the 8x10 of her holding the baby. Bosch saw tears start to show in her eyes. "Nick took these," she whispered. "I never saw them."
Bosch nodded. They were in his camera in an attic for many years, he said. What is your daughter's name?
We call her Viviana, Gabriella said. It was the name he wanted.
After his mother. Her eyes came up off the photo to his.
Who are you? She asked.
If I could come in, there is a lot I need to tell you, Bosch said. She hesitated for a moment, then stepped back and allowed him in. Bosch initially explained his presence by telling Gabriella that he had been hired by someone in Dominic Santanella's family to see if he had fathered a child before he passed. She accepted that, and over the course of the next hour they sat in her small living room, and Bosch heard the story of the short-lived love affair between Gabriella and Dominic. It was a different angle on the story that Hallie Lewis from Tallahassee had told Bosch. Gabriella had met Dominic in a bar in Oceanside with the express purpose of awakening him to his cultural roots and pride. But those motives soon took a back seat to the passion that bloomed between them, and they became a couple.
We made plans for after he came back and was discharged, Gabriella said. He wanted to be a photographer. We were going to do a project together on the border. He was going to shoot it, I was going to paint it.
She said that she found out she was pregnant when he was near the end of his training at Pendleton and was waiting to receive orders to Vietnam. It was a heart-wrenching time, and he repeatedly offered to desert the Navy to stay with her. Each time she talked him out of it, an effort that later brought a crushing guilt down on her after she learned he was killed overseas. She confirmed that Dominic had snuck back into the country twice while on leaves from Vietnam. The first time he attended the dedication of Chicano Park, and the second time it was to see his newborn daughter. The family spent the only 4 days they'd ever have together at the Del Coronado. She said the photograph that Bosch showed her was taken after an impromptu marriage on the beach, officiated by an artist friend who was ordained in a cult-like Mexican religion called Brujeria.
It was in fun, she said. We thought we would get the chance to get married for real when he came back at the end of the year.
Bosch asked why Gabriella never reached out to Dominic's family after his death, and she explained that she had feared his parents might try to take the baby away from her.
I lived in a barrio, she said. I had no money. I was worried that they could win in court and take Viviana from me. That would have killed me.
Bosch did not mention how closely Gabriella's feelings mirrored the plight of her daughter's grandmother and namesake, but her answer served as a segue to questions about Viviana and where she was. Gabriella revealed that she lived in Los Angeles and was an artist as well. She was a sculptress, living and working in the arts district downtown. She had been married once, but now was not. The kicker was that she was raising a 9-year-old boy from that marriage. His name was Gilberto Veracruz. Bosch realized he had found another heir. Whitney Vance had a great-grandson he never knew about.
Chapter 27 The San Diego County Bureau of Vital Records and Statistics was open until 5 p.m. Bosch walked hurriedly through the door at 4:35 and luckily found no one in line at the window marked birth certificates, death certificates, changes of name. He had only a single document to request, and getting it now would save him from having to stay in San Diego overnight. Bosch left the Mercado Apartments, convinced that Viviana and Gilberto Veracruz were direct descendants of Whitney Vance. If that could be proved, they were in line to inherit the Vance fortune. Genetic analysis would, of course, be the key, but Bosch also wanted to gather legal documentation that would go hand in hand with the science and be part of a judge-convincing package. Gabriella had told him that she put Dominic's name down on her daughter's birth certificate. Details like that would make the package complete. At the window, Bosch provided the name, Viviana Santanello, and the date she was born, and requested a certified copy of her birth certificate. While he waited for the clerk to find and print it, he considered some of the other revelations and confirmations that came out of his conversation with Gabriella. Bosch had asked her how she had learned of Santanello's death in Vietnam, and said she knew in her heart that he had been killed
when a week went by and she did not receive a letter from him. He had never gone that long without writing her. Her intuition was sadly confirmed when later she saw a story in the newspaper. The shooting down of a single helicopter in Vietnam had hit Southern California particularly hard. All the Marines on the chopper had California hometowns and had previously been stationed at El Toro Marine Air Base in Orange County. The lone corpsman who was killed had trained at Camp Pendleton in San Diego after being raised in Oxnard. Gabriella also told Vosh that Dominic's face was on one of the murals at the park. She had put it there many years before. It was on the mural called the Face of Heroes. Several depictions of men and women forming one face. Vosh remembered seeing the mural as he had walked through the park earlier that day. "Here you are, sir," the clerk said to Vosh. "You pay at the window to your left." Vosh took the document from the clerk and proceeded to the cash window. He studied it as he walked and saw the name Dominic Santinello listed as father. He realized how close he was to finishing the journey Whitney Vance had sent him on. He was disappointed that the old man would not be on hand at the finish line. He was soon back on the 5 and heading north. He had told Gabriella that it was in her best interests to reveal nothing about her conversation with Vosh to anyone else. They had not immediately reached out to Viviana, because Gabriella said her daughter led a life devoid of the trappings of digital technology. She had no cell phone, and rarely answered the phone in the studio loft where she lived and worked. Vosh planned to be at Viviana's studio the next morning. Meanwhile, on the brutal rush hour drive back up to L.A., he spoke at length on his cell to Mickey Haller, who said he had made some subtle inquiries of his own. "Pasadena did sign off on it as a natural, but there will be an autopsy," he said. "I think Kapoor wants the headline, so he's going to milk cause of death for all it's worth." Bhavin Kapoor was the embattled chief medical examiner of Los Angeles County. In recent months, he had come under fire for mismanagement and delays in processing autopsies at the office that handled more than 8,000 of them a year. Law enforcement agencies and loved ones of murder and accident victims complained that some autopsies were taking months to complete, delaying investigations, funerals, and closure. The media piled on further when it was revealed that some bodies got mixed up in the Big Crypt, a giant refrigerated storage center that held over 100 cadavers, toe tags blown off by the giant turbine fans that kept things cold had been reattached to the wrong toes. Looking for headlines that didn't involve scandal, Kapoor had evidently decided to proceed with an autopsy on Whitney Vance's body so that he could hold a press conference that was about something other than his handling of his duties and department. "You watch, though," Haller said. "Some smart reporter will turn this against him by pointing out that the billionaire didn't have to wait in line for an autopsy while every other body does. Even in death, the rich get treated special. That'll be the headline." Vosh knew the observation was dead-on accurate and was surprised that Kapoor's advisors, if he had any, had not warned him. Haller asked what Vosh had found in San Diego, and Harry reported that there might be two blood descendants in play. He recounted his conversation with Gabriella and told Haller that it might be soon time for DNA analysis. He outlined what he had. A sealed sample from Vance, though he did not witness the old man being swabbed. Several items that belonged to Dominic Santinello, including a razor that might have his blood on it. A swab sample he had taken from Gabriella Lita in case it was needed, and he planned to swab Viviana when he met her the following day. For the moment, he planned to leave Viviana's son, Vance's presumed great-grandson, out of it. "The only thing that's going to matter is Viviana's DNA," Haller said. "We will need to show the hereditary chain, which I think you have in hand. But it's going to come down to her DNA and whether they match it to Vance's as direct descendant." "We need to do it as a blind, right?" Vosh said. "Not tell them the swab is from Vance. Just give them the swab from Viviana, then see what they say." "Agreed. Last thing we want is for them to know whose DNA they have. I will work on that and set something up in one of the labs I gave you. Whichever one will do it the fastest. Then when you get the blood from Viviana, we go in." "I'm hoping that will be tomorrow." "That'll be good. What did you do with the swab from Vance?"
My refrigerator. Not sure that's the safest place, and I don't think refrigeration is required. It's not, I just hid it in there. I like the idea of keeping it separate from the will and the pen. Don't want everything in the same place. I'm just concerned with it being in your house. It's probably the first place they'll look. There you go with that they thing again. I know, but it is what it is. Maybe you should think of another place. Bosch told Haller about his run-in with Creighton and Harry's suspicion that there might be camera surveillance on his house. I'll check it out tomorrow morning first thing, he said. It'll be dark by the time I get there tonight. The point is, there was nobody out there this morning when I left. I checked my car for a GPS tag, and yet somehow Creighton's following me up Laurel Canyon Boulevard. Maybe it was a fucking drone, Haller said. They're being used all over the place now. I'll have to remember to start looking up. You too. Creighton said they knew you were on the case, too. Not a surprise. Bosch could see the lights of downtown now through the windshield. He was finally getting close to home, and he could feel the exhaustion from the day on the road settling on his body. He was bone-tired and wanted to rest. He decided that he would skip dinner in favor of extra sleep time. His mind wandered from the conversation when the thought of food reminded him that he needed to call or text his daughter to tell her he had driven home and wouldn't be passing by campus the next day. Their getting together would have to wait. Maybe that was a good thing, Bosch thought. After their last phone call, it might be better to have some time and distance between them. Harry, you still there? Haller said. Bosch came out of his unrelated thoughts. Here, he said. You just cut out for a second. I'm going through a bad cell area. Go ahead. Haller said he wanted to discuss a strategy involving where and when they should make a move in court. It was a subtle form of judge shopping, but he explained that deciding in what courthouse to file the will could give them an advantage. He said he assumed that probate on Vance would be opened in Pasadena, near where he lived and died, but that did not require a claimant to file there as well. If Viviana Veracruz was determined to establish herself as Vance's heir, then she could file her claim at a courthouse convenient to her. To Bosch, these were decisions that were above his pay grade, and he told Haller so. His job here and his responsibility and promise to Vance was simply to find the heir, if one existed, and gather the evidence to prove the bloodline. Legal strategies involving the subsequent claim to the Vance fortune were for Haller to decide. Bosch added something that he had been thinking about since his conversation with Gabriella. What if they don't want it? He asked. What if who doesn't want what? Haller replied. The money, Bosch said. What if Viviana doesn't want it? These people are artists. What if they don't want to be involved in running a corporation, sitting on a board of directors, being in that world? When I told Gabrielle that her daughter and grandson might be in line for a lot of money, she just shrugged it off. She said she hadn't had any money for 70 years and didn't want any now. Not going to happen, Haller said. This is change the world money. She'll take it. What artist doesn't want to change the world? Most want to change it with their art, not their money. Bosch got a call waiting signal and saw that it was from one of the SFPD exchanges. He thought maybe it was Bella Lourdes calling with the results of the second search of the Sahagun house. He told Haller he needed to go and would check in with him the next day after he found Viviana and spoke to her. He switched over, but it wasn't Lourdes calling. Bosch, Chief Valdez, where are you?
Heading north, just passing by downtown. What's up?
Are you with Bella?
Bella, no. Why would I be with Bella?
Valdez ignored Bosch's question and asked another. The serious tone in his voice had Bosch's attention. Have you heard from her today?
Not since this morning when we talked on the phone. Why? What's going on, Chief?
We can't find her, and we're not getting any answers on her cell or the radio. She signed in this morning on the board in the D Bureau, but never signed out. It's not like her. Trevino was working on budgets with me today, so he was never in the D Bureau. He never saw her.
Her car in the lot?
Both her personal car and her plane wrap are still in the lot, and her partner called and said she hasn't come home.
A hollow opened up in the middle of his chest.
Did you talk to Sisto? He asked.
Yeah, he hasn't seen her either, Valdez said.
He said she called him this morning to see if he was available to go with her into the field, but he was tied up on a commercial burglary. Bosch pushed his foot farther down on the gas pedal. Chief, send a car right now up to the Sahagun house. That was where she was going.
Why? What was it?
Just send the car, Chief. Now. Tell them to search inside and outside the house, the backyard in particular. We can talk after. I'm on my way and we'll be there in 30 minutes or less. Send that car.
Right away.
Bosch disconnected and called Bella's number, though he knew it was unlikely she would answer for him if she wasn't answering for the police chief. It rang through to voicemail, and Bosch disconnected. He felt the hollow in his chest growing wider and deeper. Chapter 28 Bosch broke away from the crushing evening traffic after passing by downtown. With speed and a legal use of the carpool lane, he covered the remaining distance to San Fernando in 20 minutes. He felt lucky to be in the rental, because he knew his old Cherokee wouldn't have reached the speeds he maintained on his way. In the station, he moved quickly through the back hallway to the chief's office, but found it empty. The hanging toy helicopter moving in a circular pattern, propelled by a breeze from the overhead air conditioning vent. He then moved on to the detective bureau and found Valdez standing at Lourdes's cubicle, along with Trevino, Sisto, and Sergeant Rosenberg, the evening watch commander. He could tell by the concerned looks on their faces that they still hadn't located the missing detective. "You checked the Sahagun house?" he asked. "We sent a car over there," Valdez said. "She's not there. Doesn't look like she ever was." "Damn," Bosch said. "Where else are you looking?"
"Never mind that," Trevino said. "Where were you today?"
He said it in an accusatory tone, as if Bosch had some knowledge of the missing detective's whereabouts.
"I had to go to San Diego," Bosch said. "One of my private cases. Went there and back."
"Then who the hell is Ida Towns Forsythe?"
Bosch looked at Trevino.
"What?
You heard me. Who is Ida Towns Forsythe?"
He held up a printout of Forsythe's DMV information, and Bosch suddenly realized he had left it in the printer tray that morning when he was distracted by the call to the lobby to see Creighton.
"Right. I forgot. I was in here this morning for about 20 minutes, he said. "I printed that out, but what's that got to do with Bella?"
"We don't know," Trevino said. "We're trying to figure out what the fuck is going on here. I find this in the printer and then check our DMV account to see if it was Bella who pulled it up, and instead I see that you ran this. Who is she?"
"Look, Ida Forsythe has nothing to do with this, okay? She's part of the private case I'm working."
Bosch knew it was an admission he should not have made, but he wasn't in the mood for sparring with Trevino, and he wanted to get the focus quickly back on Bella. For a moment, Trevino's face betrayed him. Bosch could see his barely masked delight in knowing he had just outed Bosch in front of the man who had brought him into the department.
"No, not okay," Trevino said. "That's a firing offense, and it could mean charges as well."
Trevino looked at Valdez as he said it, as if to say, "I told you this guy was just using us for access."
"Tell you what, Cap," Bosch said. "You can fire me and charge me as soon as we find Bella."
Bosch turned and directed the next question to Valdez. "What else are we doing?" he asked.
"We brought everybody in, and they're out looking," the chief said. "We put it out to the LAPD and Sheriff's Department as well."
"Why'd you tell us to check the Sahagun house?"
"Because she told me this morning that she would go search it again," Bosch said.
"Why?"
Bosch quickly explained the conversation he'd had with Lourdes this morning, including his theory that the screen cutter might have lost the key to his getaway car, which would explain his running from the scene of the crime and trying to find an unlocked car to boost.
"There was no key," Sisto said. "I would have found it."
"Never hurts to double check with fresh eyes," Bosch said.
"When she called to see if you could go into the field, did she ask about GTAs in Area 2 on Friday?"
Sisto realized that was a detail he had not mentioned to the chief and the captain earlier.
"Yeah, that's right. She did," he said. "I told her I hadn't had time to look at auto thefts from Friday yet."
Trevino moved quickly to the row of clipboards hung on the wall behind Sisto's desk. This is where the property crimes report were kept on different clipboards, depending on the crime. Trevino grabbed the clipboard marked autos and looked at the top sheet.
He then flipped back through several of the reports. We've got one Friday in Area 3, he said, another on Saturday.
Valdez turned to Rosenberg.
Irwin, take those reports, he said. Send a car to each location, have them find out if Lourdes was out there doing follow-up.
Roger that, Rosenberg said. I'll take one myself.
He took the whole clipboard from Trevino and quickly headed out of the bureau.
Is there anybody still over in public works? Bosch asked.
This time of the night they're closed, Valdez said. Why?
Can we get in?
This morning Bella said she was going over there to borrow a metal detector for the search up at the Sahagun house.
I know we can at least get into the yard, Trevino said. We gas up the cars in there.
Let's go, Valdez said.
The four men left the station through the front door and quickly crossed the street to the public works complex. They walked down the left side of the structure to the vehicle and storage yard's entrance gate, which Valdez opened with a key card pulled from his wallet. As they entered the yard, the men split up and started looking for Lourdes in and among the various work trucks and vans. Bosch headed toward the back wall, where there was a covered workshop and assorted tool benches. Behind him, he heard the vehicle doors being opened and closed, and the chief's strained voice calling out Bella's name. But there was no response. Bosch used the light from his phone to find a switch that turned on the fluorescent lights in the workshop. There were three separate benches positioned perpendicular to the back wall. These benches had racks of tools and materials, as well as anchored machines and devices like pipe cutters, grinders, and woodworking drills and saws. It looked like projects were left in mid-course on each of the benches. Above the third bench, there was an overhead rack holding several 8-foot lengths of stainless steel pipe. Bosch remembered Lourdes saying they used a metal detector to find underground pipes. He assumed the third bench was for plumbing and drainage-related projects, and that if there was a metal detector, it would be there. Lourdes had described a metal detector as something with wheels like a lawnmower, and not the kind of handheld detector he had seen used by treasure hunters on the beach. Bosch didn't see anything, and turned in a circle with his eyes scanning all of the equipment on and surrounding the workbenches. He finally spotted a crossbar handle extending out from under one of the benches. He walked over and pulled out a bright orange device on wheels that was about half the size of a push mower. He had to study it to know what it was. There was a control panel attached to the crossbar. He pushed the on-off button, and an LED screen lit with a triangular radar display and other controls for scope and depth. "It's here," he said.
His words drew the other three men over from their own fruitless searches.
"Well, if she used it, she brought it back," Valdez said.
The chief kicked one of his boots against the concrete floor, showing his frustration with another lead that didn't pan out. Bosch put both hands on the metal detector's handle and lifted. He got the two back wheels off the ground, but even that was a struggle.
"This thing is heavy," he said. "If she used it, then she had help getting it out there to the Sahagun house. It wouldn't have fit in a plane wrap."
"Should we check inside for her?" Sisto asked. The chief turned and looked at the door that led to the public work offices. Three of them walked over, and Bosch followed after parking the metal detector back in its place. Valdez tried the door, but it was locked with a deadbolt. Valdez turned to Sisto, the youngest among them.
"Kick it," he said.
"It's a metal door, chief," Sisto said.
"Try," Valdez said. "You're a young stud."
Sisto took three shots at the door with his heel. Each one was stronger than the one before it, but the door didn't give. His brown face turned to a deep maroon with the effort. He took a deep breath and was about to try a fourth when the police chief raised an arm and stopped him.
"Okay, hold on. Hold on," Valdez said. "It's not going to give. We'll have to see if we can get somebody out here with a key."
Trevino looked at Bosch. "You got your picks on you big time?" he asked. It was the first time Trevino had ever called him that to his face, an obvious reference to Bosch's LAPD pedigree.
"Nope," Bosch said.
Harry stepped away from them and over to the nearest work truck. He reached over the hood, pulled the windshield wiper back on its hinge, and twisted it right and then left. He pulled it sharply and ripped it off the truck.
"Harry, what are you doing?" Valdez said.
"Just give me a minute," Bosch said. He took the wiper over to one of the benches and used a pair of pliers to pull the rubber blade off the flat, thin metal strip that backed it. He then took a pair of metal snips to cut off 2 3-inch lengths of the strip. He picked up the pliers again and fashioned the 2 metal strips into a pick and a flat hook. He had what he needed in less than 2 minutes. Bosch went back to the door, squatted in front of the deadbolt, and went to work. "You've done that before," Valdez said. "A few times," Bosch said. "Somebody put a phone light on this." All three of the other men turned on cell lights and put the beams over Bosch's shoulder and onto the deadbolt. It took Bosch 3 more minutes to turn the lock and open the door. "Bella?" Valdez called out as they answered. No answer. Sisto hit the light switches, and they went down a hallway as the fluorescence blasted the darkness, peeling off one at a time into the offices they passed. Valdez kept calling out his missing detective's name, but the offices were as quiet as a church on a Monday night. Bosch was the last to peel off, entering the code enforcement bullpen, whose 3 cubicles were just as cramped as the detective bureau across the street. He made his way around the room, looking down into each cubicle, but seeing no sign of Lourdes. Soon Sisto came in. "Anything?" "No." "Shit." Bosch saw the nameplate on one of the desks. It reminded him of something else from his morning conversation with Lourdes. "Sisto, did Bella have a problem with Dockweiler?" "What do you mean?" "This morning when she said she was going to come over here to borrow the metal detector, she said she could ask Dockweiler for help. Then she said something about hoping he was in a good mood. Was there a problem between them? Maybe because she kept her job and he got transferred to public works? Sounded like something else." Sisto had to consider the question further before coming up with another answer.
I don't think it was that big of a deal, but back when he was in the bureau with us, I remember there was sometimes friction between them. I don't think at first Doc picked up on the fact that she played for the other team. He made a comment about a lesbian, I forget who she was, but he called her a carpet muncher or something like that. But Bella jumped all over his shit and things were kind of tense for a while there.
Bosch studied Sisto, expecting more. "That was it?" he prompted.
"I guess so," Sisto said.
"I mean, I don't know." "What about you? You have a problem with him?"
"Me?
No, we were fine." "You talk to him? Shoot the shit?"
"Yeah, some. Not a lot."
"Does he not like lesbians, or is it women he doesn't like?"
"No, he isn't gay, if that's what you mean."
"That's not what I mean. Come on, Sisto, what kind of guy is he?"
"Look, man, I don't know.
He told me once that when he worked for the sheriffs up at Wayside, they did things to the gays." That struck a chord with Bosch. Wayside Honor Rancho was a county jail located in the Santa Clarita Valley. All new deputies were assigned to jail duty right out of the academy. Bosch remembered Lourdes telling him that when it appeared that it would be several years before she got a chance to transfer out of the jail division, she started applying to other departments and ended up at San Fernando.
"What things did they do?"
"He said they put them in situations, you know, put them in modules where they knew they would get fucked with, beat up. They took bets and stuff on how long they'd last before they got jumped."
"Did he know Bella when she was there?"
"I don't know. I never asked." "Who came to San Fernando first?"
"Pretty sure it was Doc."
Bosch nodded. Dockweiler had seniority on Bella, yet she was retained instead of him when the budget crisis hit. That had to have built animosity.
"What happened when he got moved out of the department?" he asked. "Was he angry?"
"Well, yeah, wouldn't you be?" Sisto answered.
"But he was cool about it. They found him the spot over here, so it was kind of lateral. He didn't even lose salary.
Except no badge and no gun."
"I think code enforcement has a badge."
"Not the same, Sisto. You ever heard the phrase, if you're not cop, you're little people?"
No.
Bosch grew quiet as he studied the top of Dockweiler's desk. Nothing he saw seemed suspicious. He heard the dinging of a text on Sisto's phone. Pinned to the privacy wall between Dockweiler's and another desk was a map of the city, partitioned into 4 code enforcement zones that mirrored the police department's patrol areas. There was also a list of tips for spotting illegal garage conversions with photo examples of each giveaway. extension cords, cables, and hoses running from house to garage, tape over the seams of the garage door, air conditioning units on garage walls, barbecue grills closer to the garage than the house, boats, bikes, and other garage property stored outside. Studying the list, Bosch pictured the houses where the screen cutter rapes had occurred. Just 3 days ago, he had driven the circuit that included all four places. He saw now what he didn't see then. Each had a garage. Each was in a neighborhood where illegal garage conversions were a problem and would draw the attention of code inspectors. Beatrice Sagahun's house had a garage, too.
"It was him," Bosch said quietly.
Sisto didn't hear him. Bosch kept grinding it down, putting things together. Dockweiler could roam the city as a code inspector. He would have knocked on doors to perform inspections and selected his victims when he saw them in the course of his work. It was the reason to wear the mask each time. He realized also that it was Dockweiler who had the extra key to Bosch's desk. He'd kept it when he left the department, but snuck back to read the file in the investigation once Bosch had connected the cases. He knew what Bosch knew, and what he was doing at every step of the investigation. And the horror of it all, Bosch knew, was that he had sent Lourdes right to him. The fear and guilt of that realization boiled up in him. He turned away from the desk and saw Sisto typing a text on his phone. "Is that Dockweiler?" he demanded. "Are you texting Dockweiler?"
"No, man, it's my girlfriend," Sisto said.
"She wants to know where I am. Why would I text?"
Bosch snatched the phone out of Sisto's hand and looked at the screen.
"Hey, what the fuck?" Sisto exclaimed.
Bosch read the text and confirmed it was an innocuous home soon missive. He then flipped the phone back at the young detective, but the toss was too hard for such a close distance. It went right through Sisto's hands, hit him square in the chest, and then clattered to the floor.
"You asshole," Sisto yelled as he quickly dropped down to grab the phone off the floor.
"It better not be..."
As he straightened up, Bosch moved in, grabbed him by the front of his shirt, and drove him back into the room's door, banging his back and head hard against it. He then moved right up into his face.
"You lazy fuck. You should have gone with her today. Now she's out there somewhere, and we have to find her. Do you understand?"
Bosch racked him hard against the door again.
"Where does Dockweiler live?"
"I don't know. Get the fuck off me!"
Sisto shoved Bosch off with such force that he was nearly driven into the opposite wall. He hit a counter with his hip, and an empty glass coffee pot fell off its hot plate and shattered on the floor. Drawn by the harsh voices and crashing glass, Valdez and Trevino came charging through the door. It swung right into Sisto, hitting him from behind and knocking him out of the way.
"What the hell's going on?" Valdez demanded.
One hand holding the back of his head, Sisto pointed a finger at Bosch with the other.
"He's crazy! Keep him the fuck away from me!"
Bosch pointed right back at him.
"You should have gone with her, but you gave her a bullshit line and she went up there on her own."
"What about you, old man? It wasn't my case, it was yours. You should have been there, not me."
Bosch turned away from him and looked at Valdez.
"Dockweiler," he said. "Where does he live?"
"Up in Santa Clarita, I think," Valdez said. "At least he did when he worked for me. Why? What's going on here?"
He put a hand on Bosch's shoulder to keep Bosch from moving towards Sisto.
Bosch shrugged it off and pointed at Dockweiler's desk, like it was incontrovertible evidence of something only he could see.
"It's him," Bosch said. "Dockweiler's the screen cutter, and he's got Bella."
Chapter 29. They took two cars and headed Code 3 up the 5 freeway. Valdez and Bosch were in the lead car, with Valdez behind the wheel. The police chief had wisely separated Bosch from Sisto, who drove the second car with Trevino riding shotgun, and probably miffed that the tensions between Bosch and Sisto had resulted in his being separated from the chief. Valdez was on the phone barking an order to someone in the communications center.
"I don't care," he said. "Call whoever you have to call. Just get me the goddamn address. I don't care if you need to send cars to their houses to get a response."
He disconnected and cursed. So far, the comm center had not been able to make contact with the director of public works or the city manager to get access to city payroll records and Dockweiler's address. They had checked DMV records before leaving the station and found that Dockweiler had somehow managed himself, or benefited from a bureaucratic glitch, to keep a law enforcement officer block on his address nearly 5 years after leaving the police department. So they were heading to the Santa Clarita Valley based solely on Valdez's memory that Dockweiler lived somewhere up there 5 years ago. "We might get up there and have no place to go," Valdez said. He banged the steering wheel with an open palm and changed the subject. "What was that all about back there with Sisto, Harry?" he asked. "I've never seen you act like that."
"I'm sorry, Chief," Bosch said. "I lost it. If I could have thrown myself against the door, I would have. But I took it out on Sisto."
"Took what out?"
"I should have been with Bella today. My case, I should have been there. Instead, I told her to take Sisto. And I should have known she'd go alone if he wasn't around. Look, we don't even know if this Dockweiler thing is legit, so hold off on beating yourself up. I need you focused here."
Valdez pointed north through the windshield. Bosch tried to think of another source for Dockweiler's address. If he was still employing law enforcement protection measures, they would be hard-pressed to find him. He thought about calling Wayside and seeing if any of the jail deputies remembered him and might know his address. It seemed like a long shot since Dockweiler had left the sheriff's department so long ago.
"When did he first come to work for San Fernando?" Bosch asked.
"It was 05 or 06, I think," Valdez said. "He was already here when I got here."
"Yeah, it would have been 06, because I remember he was just past 5 years invested when I had to chop him in 2012.
Sisto told me about saying he was part of a group of deputies at Wayside that manipulated custodies and staged fights.
I remember they weeded out a bunch of jail deputies back around then. The Wayside Whiteys, remember?"
It was coming back to Bosch. It was hard to remember specific groups or incidents because it seemed to him that the sheriff's department had suffered one jail scandal after another in the last decade. The previous sheriff had resigned in disgrace during an FBI investigation of jail issues, and he faced a corruption trial. Several of his deputies had already gone to prison. These were some of the reasons Bella Lourdes had told Bosch she needed to get out, even if it meant moving to a much smaller department like San Fernando's.
"So why did you chop him instead of Bella?" Bosch asked. "He had seniority, right?"
"He did, but I had to do what was best for the department," Valdez said.
"Nice political answer."
"It's the truth. You know Bella. She's a go-getter. Loves a job, wants to give back. Dockweiler, he was a bit of a bully. So when Marvin told me I could offer one of my people the job in code enforcement, I kept Lourdes and transferred Dockweiler. I thought it suited him. You know, telling people to cut their lawns and trim their hedges."
Marvin was Marvin Hodge, the city manager. Bosch shook his head as the chief's answer reminded him of his failings on the screen cutter case.
"What?" Valdez asked.
"I think I made the right choice."
"No, it's not that," Bosch said. "You did make the right choice. But you probably didn't with me. I missed a lot on this one. I guess the time off made me rusty."
"What did you miss?"
"Well, last Friday I took a drive past the first four crime scenes, the ones we knew about. You know, all in one trip, and in the order of occurrence. I'd never done that before, and I was trying to see if anything would spark, if I would finally figure out what the link was. And I didn't see it. It was right there, and I didn't see it. All the houses had garages."
"Yeah, but that's so common. Practically every house built since World War II has a garage. In this town, that's just about everybody."
"Doesn't matter. I should have put it together.
I'll bet you my next paycheck that we're going to find that Dockweiler inspected those houses and those garages for unpermitted conversion and habitation. He has a damn tip sheet pinned to the wall of his cubicle. That's how he picked his victims. That's why he wore the masks, because the victims might remember him from the inspection. You don't get a paycheck, Harry. And after this, I don't deserve one."
"Look, as far as Dockweiler goes, this is all just theory right now. We don't have a shred of evidence he's a screen cutter. Theory looks good, but theories don't get convictions."
"It's him."
"Just because you keep saying it doesn't make it so."
"Well, you better hope it is. Otherwise, we're looking for Bella in the wrong place."
That was a thought that brought silence to the car for the next few miles. But after a while, Bosch started asking questions so he didn't have to dwell on thoughts about Bella.
"How did Dockweiler take getting shit canned?" he asked.
"When you put it like that, it sounds pretty bad," Valdez said.
But every time we had to make a cutback, we did our best to place people or come up with a plan for them. So like I said, Marvin gave me the slot at Public Works to use, and I came to Doc Weiler with that. He took it, but he wasn't too happy about it. He wanted us to move the position from Public Works to the police department, but it doesn't work that way. Did he resent that Lourdes and Sisto weren't cut first? Well, I don't know if you know this, but Sisto is the son of a longtime city council member, so he wasn't going anywhere, and Doc Weiler knew that. So yes, he mostly focused his upset on Bella. Said she was staying and he was going because she was a twofer. Then asked me if her being a lesbian made her a threefer. The chief's phone rang and he immediately took it. Go, he said. He listened and then repeated an address on Stonington Drive, Saugus, for Bosch to memorize. Bosch recognized the address and immediately felt a charge as one more confirmation on Dockweiler clicked. Interesting, Valdez said into the phone. Shoot me a map link on a text for that second place. And you better start the call-outs on SRT. Depending on what we'll get up here, I'll make the call on that. Send me another text when you've got everybody ready to roll. Bosch knew that the Special Response Team was the SFPD's version of SWAT. The officers on the team came from all over the department, and all had critical incident and high-level weapons training. Valdez disconnected. Did you plot that address on GPS, he asked? No, Bosch said. I already know how to get there. It's up in Haskell Canyon, and Bella and I were up in that neighborhood Saturday tracing the screen cutter's knife. You're kidding me. Nope. Dockweiler's got to be the guy. The original owner of the knife reported it stolen out of his car in his driveway. He told us a sheriff's deputy was living across the street from him at the time. Dockweiler probably knew that deputy had been in that part of the neighborhood. Maybe he saw the original owner with a knife. I don't know how exactly, but I do know it's too close to be a coincidence. There are no coincidences. Dockweiler stole the knife. Valdez nodded. He was becoming a believer. It's coming together, Harry, he said. Let's just hope it's not too late for Bella, Bosch said. Chapter 30 Bosch directed Valdez into Saugus and into a neighborhood on the other side of the Haskell Canyon Wash, from where the screen cutter's knife had been stolen from its original owner. Along the way, the police chief filled Bosch in on the second part of the phone call he had received from the comm center. He explained that the city had a policy that required all employees to seek approval if they worked second jobs. This allowed the city to guard against employees getting involved in conflicts of interest or second jobs that might be embarrassing. The policy was enacted a decade earlier when the Los Angeles Times reported that an assistant city manager was also producing and performing in porno videos under the name Torrid Tory. So 2 years ago, Dockweiler applied for and got clearance to work a part-time night security job at the Harris Movie Ranch over in Canyon Country, Valdez said. Gives us a secondary location. You ever been up there? Never have, Bosch said. Pretty cool place. I went up there a couple of times with my brother-in-law, who's a screenwriter. It's huge, like a couple hundred acres where they film all kinds of things. Westerns, detective shit, even sci-fi. There's all kinds of structures in the woods that they use for shootouts and that kind of stuff. If Dockweiler has access, then I hate to say it, but we could be searching up there for Bella till dawn. So I put SRT on standby. We'll know if we need them after we get to Dockweiler's house and see what's there. Bosch nodded. It was a good plan. How do you want to do his house, he asked. Go straight at it, or ski it first? Or do what first, Valdez asked. Ski it. You don't remember that from LAPD? Short for schematic. You know, check the place out on the sly, then draw up a plan, as opposed to just knocking on the door. Okay, then. I think we should ski it. You? Agreed. Valdez called Trevino and filled him in on everything, including the movie ranch angle that might come into play later. He gave them the confirmed address of Dockweiler's house, and they worked out a plan in which the cars would enter the block from opposite ends, park, and then the four men would proceed on foot, checking out the house and meeting in the backyard if it was accessible. Remember, Valdez said, this guy was a cop. We need to count on him having weapons. By the time the call was finished, they were in the neighborhood, and it was time to split off. Valdez killed the lights. He entered the block from the north side and parked three houses short of the Dockweiler address.
Before getting out of the car, both Bosch and Valdez drew their weapons and pulled back the slides to make sure there was a round in the chamber. They then reholstered. Bosch assumed that he had more tactical experience than the police chief, so he took the lead without talking about it first. Valdez fell in behind as they moved up the street. It was not an urban environment. There were no cars parked on the street and very few in driveways. It afforded little cover, and Bosch easily zeroed in on Sisto and Trevino working their way down the opposite end of the block. Bosch cut in toward the front of the house that was next door to Dockweiler's. He held by the corner of the garage. Valdez came up next to him, and they studied Dockweiler's home. It was a ranch-style house of modest size. There were no fences preventing access to the rear yard. That most likely meant no dogs. The light over the front door was on, but there appeared to be no lights on inside the house. Bosch nodded to Valdez, and they moved across the side yard and then toward the rear of Dockweiler's house. Bosch tried to get a view inside through every window they passed, but curtains were pulled, or it was too dark in the house to see inside. When Bosch and Valdez got to the backyard, Trevino and Sisto were already there, standing by an outdoor barbecue. There was also a light on over the back door, but the wattage was low, and it didn't reach very far. The four men convened by the barbecue. Bosch looked around. The backyard sloped down into the wash, where it was pitch black. He checked the back of the house once more and noticed a build-out from the right side, a small room with mostly glass walls. It looked like a mismatched addition to the house, and he wondered if Dockweiler, a code enforcement officer, had added on the room without permit. "Looks like nobody's home," Sisto said. "We need to be sure," Bosch said. "How about you two stay on the back door and the chief and I go knock on the door up front?" "Sounds like a plan," Valdez said, before either of the other two could object to their backup duties. Bosch headed back down the side of the house and Valdez followed, after instructing the backyard team to stay alert. They were almost to the front corner when headlights swept across the lawn as a vehicle turned into the driveway. Bosch ducked in against the house, and Valdez posted up behind him. There was a rumbling sound, and Bosch knew it was the sound of the garage opening. But it wasn't followed by the sound of the vehicle pulling in. Instead, Bosch heard the engine die, followed by the vehicle's door opening and closing. A few seconds later, there was another heavy metal banging sound that Bosch could not identify. Bosch looked back at Valdez and nodded. He then edged up to the corner and looked into the front yard. The vehicle was a white pickup truck with a camper shell. Bosch could see a man standing at the tailgate he had just dropped. He was leaning into the back of the truck, but Bosch could not see what he was doing. He saw no one else in or around the truck. He turned back to Valdez and whispered, "Switch places with me, and tell me if that's him," he said. They traded positions, and Valdez looked around the edge of the house. He had to wait to see him until the man ducked out of the rear of the truck. He then held out a thumbs up. It was Dockweiler. "Can you see what he's doing?" Bosch asked. "Is Bella in the truck?" Valdez shook his head. Bosch didn't know if that was no to both questions or just the first. Suddenly there was a loud chirping sound coming from the chief, and he quickly grabbed the phone off his belt and killed the sound. Of course it was too late. "Hold it right there!" The voice boomed from the front yard. It was Dockweiler. "Don't fucking move!" Bosch was behind Valdez and could not see Dockweiler. He stayed tight against the side of the house, knowing that if Dockweiler thought there was only one prowler, then Bosch might be able to do something here. "I've got a gun, and I'm a qualified marksman," Dockweiler yelled. "Step out and let me see your hands." Now the beam of a flashlight hit the corner of the house, and Valdez was lit up like a target. Valdez saw what Bosch couldn't see, but knew it was most likely the gun Dockweiler was threatening to use. Valdez raised his hands and stepped out into the light. It was a brave move, and Bosch knew it was to draw Dockweiler's attention away from the corner. "Hey, Doc." "Take it easy," Valdez said. "It's Chief Valdez. You can put the gun down." Dockweiler's voice carried genuine surprise. "Chief? What are you doing here?" Valdez kept walking straight out from the corner toward the street. Bosch quietly slipped his weapon out of its holster and held it at the ready with two hands. If he so much as heard Dockweiler cock his weapon, he would step out and take the man down.
I was looking for Bella, Valdez said.
Bella, Dockweiler said. You mean Lourdes? Why would she be up here? I think she lives in the city.
Come on, Doc. Put the weapon down. You know me.